think about, for example, whether you need to put things into pots first of all. Do you need to sow seed into pots, or could you just wait a bit longer until the soil's warmed up and then sow direct into beds in the garden, and then you're not needing to use pots nearly so much? So you could just take an entirely different approach and see if you can garden differently for a year or for a season and see how that goes. See if you still enjoy it as much, and then how much less plastic you do or don't use as a result.
Welcome to the Scotland Grows Show, the podcast where we celebrate Scottish gardening. I'm MT O'Donnell, editor and producer of Scotland Grows magazine, and your host for this adventure. We are delighted that this series of the Scotland Grows Show is sponsored by Roots, a subscription from National Trust for Scotland, which celebrates Scotland's flora in the form of a Roots pack sent to you every 6 weeks, containing Scottish seeds to grow at home, tips from expert National Trust gardeners, and stories and histories of the Scottish plants protected and cared for by the National Trust, thus helping both your garden and National Trust for Scotland's gardens thrive. In this episode, I chat to Fiona Thackeray, Chief Executive Officer of Trellis, the National Organisation for Therapeutic Gardening, supporting practitioners and their groups across the length and breadth of Scotland. Fiona has worked in therapeutic gardening for 27 years, which has taken her as far as working with students with visual impairments in Brazil, where she also helped to build Brazil's fourth sensory garden before returning to Perthshire to support therapeutic gardening projects all over Scotland. Fiona has pursued her interest in the natural world in Greece, working in sea turtle conservation, and later in Brazil, helping on a project investigating the relationship between orchids and bees in the Atlantic forest. Fiona was awarded the Dr. Andrew Duncan Medal by the Royal Caledonian Horticultural Society in 2019 in recognition of her contribution to horticulture. An award-winning writer, Fiona's plastic-free gardening book is a great read if you're looking to make your garden more sustainable and less damaging to the environment. And all profits from book sales go to support the work of Trellis. Today, I'm delighted to chat to Fiona about that very topic of plastic-free gardening. Fiona, welcome to the Scotland Grows podcast. We are delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to join you.
So let's start with the publication of the book Plastic Free Gardening. What motivated you to want to write a book, and then specifically to write this book?
Well, I am a bit of a scribbler. I do write. I write fiction and non-fiction when I'm not working at Trellis. And so I'm always open to the whisper of a book project. So there wasn't much of a hill to get over there to get me interested. But specifically this book, it's a bit of a sad story, I'm afraid. So brace yourself. I was in São Paulo State on holiday a few years ago, and we were near the coast. We were on the coast, and we decided to go to this quite remote beach, which was about 90 minutes walk from the town where we were staying. And as we got closer, we saw that there were three vultures on the sand at the far end of the beach. It was just a small beach. And as we got closer still, we saw they were pecking at something. And then when we got right up to them, we saw it was a juvenile loggerhead turtle they were pecking at. And I used to work with sea turtles, and so this was really upsetting. So we scared the vultures away, and we got close to the turtle to see how she was. And she was really quite poorly. She had some injuries on her head where they'd been pecking her. And she was still alive, but I say she could have been he. It was still alive, but very sluggish and not very lively at all. So we tried to get her in the water, and she just couldn't stay afloat. We took her back to the, not very easy to take a very heavy turtle back to the town where we were staying, 90 minutes walk back along the coast. And we left her with Project Amar, which is a Brazil-wide program for sea turtle conservation. They have a base in the town, in Ubatuba, where we were staying, and we left her there in a paddling pool with a wet t-shirt over her to keep her cool, and went back in the morning, and she hadn't made it through the night. A couple of weeks later, we got an email with the autopsy results from the veterinary scientist who looked at her, and it had been plastic ingestion. So this turtle had been trying to feed, had been taking in plastic, which often looks like jellyfish, which is their favorite food. And so Ocean Plastics had claimed the life of this turtle and basically caused her to drown and suffocate. And this is happening a lot. And the more I thought about that, the more I thought, gosh, I need to do more. I've always been interested in environmental causes, but you know, you can get complacent and think you're doing all you need to do. And of course, that clearly isn't the case. So that made me research a subject close to my heart, gardening, and to see if there was a book about how to improve your, you know, reduce your plastic use in the garden. And it seemed that there weren't. It seemed that I had stumbled across a gap in the market. And then I began thinking, could I write this book?
And you did.
And I did. Yes. And a few hundred thousand words later, I did.
You did. And it's a great book for people to buy. But before we kind of dive into some of the recommendations you make in the book, things that we as gardeners can all do, talk us through a wee bit about what the scale of the problem that we face just now with plastic use is.
Well, I think the problem starts with the fact that plastic is fantastic. So we rely on it and we love it. And it's very convenient, it's flexible, it's sterile, it's cheap, and it's disposable. The trouble is, it is quite durable as well. So that's a great thing. If you buy something like some new swings for your kids in the garden, or a paddling pool, you want it to last, or a plastic bucket, you do want it to be durable. But the stuff we use every day, the single use and the disposable stuff, and all the stuff in between, is durable too. And that means it hangs around in the environment long after we've finished using it. And because it's become so ubiquitous, because we're also addicted to plastic in a way and find it so convenient to use, we are disposing of much more than the environment can really cope with, and it's hanging around, you know, it's still there in the environment hundreds of years later. So there's this problem, this dichotomy where plastic's a great product, but if it's disposed of wrongly, or if we don't have adequate recycling systems, it becomes a problem. And so it can get into the environment either through rain or windstorms, or animals carrying pieces of plastic away, improper disposal, which I'm sure we've all been guilty of at one stage or another, overwhelmed or inadequate recycling systems, and lots of other problems. And so we end up with things like the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is effectively an island that can be seen from space, which is fragments of plastic and fishing waste floating on the ocean. And fatbergs, which we've all heard about too, those disgusting, greasy accumulations of plastic and other waste that gets stuck in our sewers and block up and cause all sorts of nasty and disgusting problems. So there's economic problems, and there's emotional and human and environmental cost to this problem, and it's not going away.
It's a massive project you took on to try and give some advice about how we garden better to either avoid the use of single-use plastics or make better use of the plastics that we've got. And the book contains lots of practical ideas about ways in which people can bring that into their own garden. So maybe you want to talk us through some simple examples of maybe swaps that people can make in their garden, or things that they can do to either move away from plastic usage or to prolong the life of the plastic that we do have.
Yeah, well, there's lots in that, isn't there? There's lots of tips, which I go through chapter by chapter in the book, and I sort of divide things up into landscaping materials and pots and tools and clothing. But you touched on it in your question, you know, at the heart of it all is reduce, reuse, recycle, you know, so protecting the stuff you have from UV light, from sunlight, is probably one of the simplest places to start. So instead of leaving your pots out or in the greenhouse all year round, pop them back into the shed and they will last longer. And UV light is also, and weathering in general, is one of the things that leads to plastics breaking down into microplastics. So one of the things that gives plastics their great flexibility is the fact they're made up of long chains of blocks called chemical blocks called monomers, and they join together to make polymers, which is what plastics are, and that gives them their flexibility because they're basically these long chains. But that also means they become very brittle and fragile when they get too much sun on them and too much weathering, perhaps the motion of the waves at the sea in sea or wind motion, for example. So they easily break into tiny fragments, and no one quite knows the impact of these microplastics yet that are also getting into the environment. So one simple way is to try and keep your plastic goods in the garden, whether it's pots or tools, inside, protected from UV light, and then they're less likely to break down quickly. I think one of the things that I suggest in the book is to look at the things you do most commonly. So if that's sowing lots of seeds and potting them on, then you're using a lot of pots. And if you're using plastic pots or trays, that's a good place to start, because it's something you're doing day to day. It's not something that you're doing once in a while. And therefore, it's going to have a bigger impact. So I would focus on something like pots or labels, for example, if you're using lots of plastic pots and labels, and look at the alternatives. And there are many. There are lots of new products on the market from plastics that are recyclable. So they're, just to have a side detour into these, into the problems with plastic pots, the black plastic pots are tricky to recycle because the scanners or the sensors in the recycling plants that most of us have at the heart of our municipal recycling plants in our council facilities around the country, they have little sensors to read the recycling symbols on plastic goods, and they can't read the black plastic so easily. All the light's absorbed by the black. So new pots that are more recyclable are either transparent green plastic, you might have seen those, or taupe plastic, or pink or white. There's lots of different colours coming on the market now. They're much more recyclable. So you could just simply switch to those and make sure that you're not getting pots that are difficult to recycle. And then there's pots made of all kinds of things, typically vegetable matters such as corn starch, potato starch, and bamboo. They're really sturdy replacement products. There are pots made from coir, you know, the outside of coconut husks. The Hairy Pot Company sells these amazing pots that you can just leave the plants in and the roots go right through them. And then there are the pots made from card, basically pressed cardboard or other plant fibers. So they're great. And they are generally renewable and recyclable, and in many cases compostable. So make a switch to one of those and you're already making a huge difference. And then some of the sort of DIY options are making pots out of newspaper. There's lots of videos about how to do that online, basically in the simplest form, wrapping newspaper around a cylindrical shape and then stapling it or taping it together, and or just using the pressure of other pots inside a tray to keep them together. Those are really simple ways. Or old tin cans, which apparently were used by the nurseries in the 1970s even, from domestic waste. So there are lots of DIY, zero cost or reasonably priced options to try when it comes to pots. And there are other options in all the other categories of gardening merchandise to explore. The other thing to say is to be creative. Is to think about how you garden, and just creativity doesn't really cost anything either. But think about, for example, whether you need to put things into pots first of all. Do you need to sow seed into pots, or could you just wait a bit longer until the soil's warmed up and then sow direct into beds in the garden, and then you're not needing to use pots nearly so much? So you could just take an entirely different approach and see if you can garden differently for a year or for a season and see how that goes. See if you still enjoy it as much, and then how much less plastic you do or don't use as a result.
Yeah, that's really good advice, to not replace the problem with a new solution, but just to think about a completely different way of doing it all together. And I was going to say we did go through a period where we all, I guess, had to think a wee bit more creatively during our subsequent lockdowns, when we couldn't get to garden centres and we couldn't access goods to buy. So we had to recycle, repurpose, reuse what we had lying about. And I think that's when things like using milk cartons and toilet rolls really came to the fore, and certainly everyone's social media feeds were filled with all of these things that they were making into plant pots. It's been somewhat too easy just to forget that and to go back to buying plastic again.
I think with a lot of our lockdown habits, we could say that too. But I think the ones that were really helpful have stuck around. So I think, for example, I've seen a huge blossoming of the number of products in shops and garden centres that are plastic free now. And so it's certainly got a lot easier. And the products that are really good will stick around, I think. And and be a success and still be there for us, even if we do slip back slightly in our habits there.
And it's not just obviously pots, which are the, you know, the things that we think about when we think of plastic use in the garden, although as you said earlier, they're probably the biggest thing that we think about. And what our current estimates, something like more than 500 million pots in circulation. So that is a huge problem and a huge issue in terms of the volume of plastic. But it's also things like labels on plants and plastic that our compost comes in, maybe things that are wrapped in other plastics that we buy. So are there simple swaps that you recommend for some of those other kind of sundry items in the garden?
Yeah, I think labels are probably as prolific as pots in the new products out there. There's slate, there's terracotta, there's bamboo, or there's wood labels, and those are really quite easy to find. So they're a happy case of where things are really turning around quickly. I think other things are not quite such a simple and easy picture. And I think compost wrapping is one of them. Those bags are made of film that's tricky to recycle, or the market's not quite so easy to access. I think they are recyclable, but there are not very many outlets for the average domestic gardener. So if your local supermarket or garden centre can collect those for you and recycle them, that's great, because businesses to businesses have a bit more access to those bigger, more industrial business scale recycling loops and systems. So that's one thing to try, is just to talk to your local garden centre and see if they have a scheme. I know that Stan Green at Growforth does in Fife, and I think he's encouraging other businesses to work with him for that kind of bigger scale recycling. And also to ask manufacturers about recycling when you buy, especially for bigger ticket purchases like greenhouses and so on, you know, or polytunnels, you know, ask them about that. Will you take back this polytunnel skin when I need to change it and recycle it for me? Because I can't, you know, I can't get it into my local council is not going to take this back, and I don't have access to those big business level recycling loops that you do. So that's a good practice. And also campaigning and keeping on at your local council, because some of them are changing to accept pots in the recycling, the domestic recycling bins, but many of them are still not, because of the sensor problem or because of dirt, soil contamination on plastics, which in many ways I think is probably far less of a dangerous contaminant than some of our food waste that's still on products that go into the bins. But this is the rule in many cases. And so if they hear from enough gardeners saying, come on, we really want to recycle and you're going to hit your targets better if you can change this, what can we do about it? So there's a little bit of campaigning to be done, just on a low level, local, polite local level. If you can manage it, that's always helpful.
All of these changes will be consumer driven. So the more that we tell our local garden centres, tell our local councils, tell any companies that we buy from that we would like to see alternatives to plastic use, then the more that starts to become a reality.
Absolutely. And that's clear. The horticulture industry has turned around really quickly in response to this, because they see what consumers want. And this isn't really being legislated for. I mean, local councils have their targets, and so there are clear incentives there to increase recycling and to reduce plastic use. But there's not a law coming down the line telling us we can't buy plastic pots anymore. So it is coming from consumer demand. And gardeners, I think, because they spend so much time caring for their local environment, are concerned about environmental issues, of course. And so they are one of the first groups to start being motivated to buy products that are considered to be better or have a lower environmental impact. So they're a prime market for this, and the horticulture industry knows that, because it knows as well. So the products are coming thick and fast, and I just think it's really, I saw this when I was researching for the book, that the products I was finding were multiplying and that they would be out of date and replaced by new ones, and they would be better and better every time. So I sort of stuck to giving people pointers for the kinds of things they might be looking for, because I could see the floodgates were opening. It's a really good time to be making this kind of switch in your gardening.
And so do you see that in the horticultural industry in general, that it's an exciting time, that the industry is responding to change at enough pace?
I don't know if I can say enough. I would like to think it's probably ahead of many other industry sectors without having really the same knowledge of those other sectors. But when I look at the products in the average supermarket in food and drink aisles, I think they're lagging behind a bit. And in fact, I interviewed a couple of people for the book who are relevant to this point, actually. One was Professor Richard Thompson, who looks at marine conservancy down in Plymouth, and he was instrumental in the plastic bag tax that came in a few years ago. And he said, you know, the supermarkets are still not doing enough to make it second nature for us to do this en masse, to go to the supermarket and not be bringing home more plastic that's non-recyclable. So he still takes his little folded up plastic bag there, because really it doesn't add up to only take a cotton bag to the supermarket. It doesn't really make a difference in his view. But he stands there looking at this big juice bottles wrapped with coloured film that isn't very recyclable, and despairs, because they're not making it easy enough for there to be a tipping point where we all switch, because it's so easy in the way that we all left plastic bags at home and didn't buy so many more. When the little tax came in, it made it much more of a no-brainer for people to just go, yes, I don't need another bag. And I also interviewed someone called Phil, I've forgotten his second name, from Desh Plant Pack, which makes pots and trays for the industry. And he was telling me about all the innovative different types of materials for pots that are coming on board and coming online from his factory. And it was incredible. They're making pots from materials such as tomato stems. So, you know, they're really fibrous and tough. So they're making pots from those. They're making pots out of a cardboard that doesn't go soggy until you put hot water onto it. So it's kind of it's got a built-in inhibitor to crumbling and biodegrading until it gets hot water on it. So there's all this innovation, and it's really exciting. However, he does say that he's now got, instead of a hall full of, in the sort of packing hall, full of black pots, there's a corner with taupe pots, you know, that taupe colour that we've seen, the beigey colour. And then there's another one with white, and then there's another bay with pink pots, another with green. So, you know, it still needs a bit of coordination whereby everyone just agrees on one colour, because there's still efficiencies to be made there in saving on dye and different types of plastic. You know, it'd be much more efficient if everyone just ordered the same colour. But, you know, that's a normal thing when the industry is going through a huge change like this. But certainly I've seen so many new products from all the different types of plant fibre pots, and tomato stem pots, to all the different labels made of wood and bamboo. I have to say, I think horticulture as a trade has responded really quickly and creatively to this big question.
That's great to hear, isn't it? And when like you and I go to all the big trade shows, and it's great to see the innovation coming, and that manufacturers are now trying to be much more sustainable in what they do. So it's always exciting to see these new developments coming along. But how would you respond to listeners who, let's say, are listening to this and think, okay, so, you know, I can keep using the same seed trays for the next 5-10 years. I can change my plant labels to using bamboo or lollipop sticks or something. You know, how would we respond to that when individual gardeners feel that the changes they are making are so small and so minuscule that they don't actually touch the scale of the problem?
Yeah, I did feel that way a few times during the research for the book. You know, it can be, there's a lot of sort of eco-anxiety. There's a lot of people feeling overwhelmed with concern about the state of the environment, and plastics is one of the most tangible ones, because you can see them washed up on your local beach, and of course you can see them stacked up in your shed. It creates a lot of guilt, and it makes people feel bad. And I was determined the book wasn't going to do that, because there's enough of that, and it doesn't make you feel motivated or able to do much. It might make you feel motivated, but you can end up feeling so overwhelmed that you don't actually feel you can do anything. So that's no use. And then I began to see that actually the biggest changes, I think, in environmental behaviour and things that are damaging to our environment over the last few years have been small, single acts done by lots of people, and acts that are sustainable and can be done over and over again and become a habit. I'm a terrible one for getting inspired about something and going out in a fever and just trying to change, you know, make a big change overnight that's not realistic. And then, of course, a few weeks later, I realise I'm not so enthusiastic and it quietly fades away. And that's not really going to lead to any kind of lasting change. So as we saw with the plastic bags, of course, there was a tax there and it was a legislative question. But there was behaviour change on a huge scale and billions, I think 6 billion bags were saved within 18 months. So they were taken out of the environment and saved. And they could have ended up, you know, ingested by a seabird or another creature. And wildlife charities around the world are seeing these things happening weekly now. You know, they're very frequent. So if you take away something on that scale, and that's just one country, one small country, making one change. If you take away that many plastic bags, that's okay. That's not looking at plastic bottles. It's not looking at plant pots. It's not looking at all the other things, the milk bottles that we all use. But just that one item made such a huge difference. I think that shows us what sticking to one change and making one small change in behaviour, not buying pots anymore, plastic pots, or switching to recyclable pots, and all of us doing that because it's easy, because we all manage to do it and stick to it, that is much more worth having and is going to make a much bigger dent in the problem than a few of us getting inspired, making a big grand gesture and then quietly forgetting about it a few weeks later because the product is expensive or it's too much of a hassle and we don't have time to keep making newspaper pots or whatever we've chosen that isn't going to stick. So I would say there is a lot to be gained. In fact, there's more to be gained from all of us doing one small thing that we stick to than from any kind of grand gesture.
Do one small thing, but do it well. And do it consistently.
Choose something you can stick to. Yeah.
Yeah. So given all of the great advice you've got there, Fiona, and everything that's in the book, what would be the best piece of gardening advice that you could give to new gardeners or those who are just ready, just want to start gardening, to start gardening in a way which is less plastic based, apart from, of course, buying Plastic Free Gardening book? Apart from buying the book, what else could people do to just start now? If you're a new kind of gardener, you're just getting into gardening, how do you begin now in a way that uses less plastic?
Well, you can start with some good tools. There are lots of good tool restoration projects where you can buy tools that have been restored, or just get some really nice new tools that are steel forged with wooden handles because they'll last your lifetime. And you won't need to buy any new ones, hopefully. And many companies will replace the handles if they wear out. So that's something that is, you know, avoiding that kind of endless consumption. And you just stick with one really good thing and keep using it. You can swap plants with other people. And, you know, if you have a glut, that's a really handy thing to have anyway. And raise them in maybe pots that you've inherited from someone else who's a keen gardener, or buy some recyclable plastic pots or some pots that are made of cornstarch or some other renewable recyclable material and try them out, see how you go. If you don't like those ones, there are lots of other types to try, and just find one that you can get along with and that isn't too much of a faff, isn't too expensive. It's got to fit your budget, it's got to fit your lifestyle and your available time. And find a good local nursery that can guide you to these products and that will keep stocking them if you go back and say how much you like them. And so by sharing that feedback and sharing what you do with other gardeners, you hopefully inspire other people to do the same. And so we get closer to that mass movement on a tipping point where so many people are doing it that it becomes the new normal.
That's great advice, particularly for people who are just starting out, to get started without accumulating maybe all of the stuff that more seasoned gardeners have. And let's face it, we all have potting sheds and greenhouses and secret stores of gardening stuff, but gardening needn't be an expensive activity, and it needn't be an activity where you need to accumulate lots of things. So very good advice. And what is your own garden like then, Fiona?
Well, it's a little bit jungle-like at the moment. Since I came back from holiday, I haven't quite caught up with all this very warm weather and the rain we've had. But it's a mix of lots of vegetables and fruit plants and some ornamentals, because I sort of pretend that I garden within my means and within the time I've got available. And then I ignore that and I just plant too much of everything. Everything I love, I have to go and plant. And it's too much. So it's overplanted, but it's got lots of good vegetable and fruit plants and some lovely roses and ornamentals as well.
Better to be overplanted than underplanted.
Possibly, possibly not, but that's the way it is.
So just to finish, Fiona, I've asked every guest on every podcast episode to tell us that if you could have only three plants in your garden, which three plants would you have and why? Because it's very interesting for listeners to be able to compare episode to episode, just what people would choose. So if you, and they don't have to be your favourite plants, but if you could only have three in your garden, which three would you have?
You know, this is an impossible question. I'm going to turn it back on you one day. But I have had a little think about this over the years, and I think they are slightly niche. One would be radicchio, which I love. I have a project to grow different kind of weird and wonderful Italian vegetables, and there's lots of radicchios, but there's one that's very pale called Variegata di Castelfranco, and it's kind of almost cream coloured with red freckles on the leaves. It's a beautiful thing, and it's just delicious. If you like slightly bitter, sweet vegetable, it's absolutely delicious. And then my stripy tomatoes, which if I can keep my greenhouse, I will grow under glass. And they're from saved seeds that I got in a salad one day. And I think they're Italian, but they're kind of a blend of the kind of tigerella, artisan, bumblebee types, which are stripy red and green. Delicious. I mean, out of this world taste. And I think finally, I would have to have something for the senses to gladden the heart, and probably a rose and possibly Crown Princess Margareta, because it's a beautiful kind of cabbage shaped rose, pale pink, and a lovely scent, which I think is crucial in a rose.
Oh, what a nice choice. That would be a nice garden to sit in. It would be very pretty and very productive.
Sensory and delicious.
Sensory and edible. Very, very good choices, Fiona. Well, thank you so very much for joining us on the Scotland Grows show here, and for giving us all such a kind of great background on the scale of the plastic problem in the world of horticulture, and some practical solutions for how we can push forward. And in the show notes, of course, I'll link to the book Plastic Free Gardening, so that anyone listening who would like to purchase their own copy can do so.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, Fiona. We'll hope to catch up with you again soon.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Scotland Grows Show. Don't forget to follow us on social media by searching for Scotland Grows across Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. And sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode of the Scotland Grows Show. And if you are not yet subscribed to receive Scotland Grows magazine, 6 times a year, straight to your inbox, literally packed with Scottish gardening goodness, then be sure to do so as soon as possible, and you'll even get access to all the back issues. Details can be found on our website at scotlandgrowsmagazine.com, across our social media feeds, and in the show notes for each episode. The information on the National Trust for Scotland's Root subscription is also in the show notes, and they would appreciate your support to help National Trust for Scotland's gardens and designed landscapes thrive. I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the Scotland Grows Show as we celebrate Scottish gardening.